Book of Ruth, chapter 1, page 267. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you, as you have shown to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters. It is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me." At this they wept again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. When you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning.
In case you didn't hear me before, over the Christmas break, we were down in the West Country staying with family, and we popped to see some friends who were living nearby. I had a lovely time with them. Just as we were leaving their house, our attention was drawn to a picture on the wall behind us, where it was a family tree. This was a large handwritten document, which I think dated back to about 15 or 20 generations. It was a fascinating thing to see. I think it finished in the mid-20th century, so there was still more that they basically ran out of space to fill it in. But it was only on the drive home that it occurred to me that looking at that family tree on the wall is akin to what we'll be doing over the next 3 weeks looking in the book of Ruth. We'll be looking through Jesus' family tree. Now, why are we doing that? Well, this little book of Ruth, it's squashed in between the 21 chapters of Judges and the 55 chapters of Samuel. It may be small in terms of word counts, but it is massive in terms of significance for helping us understand Jesus' family tree. As Alison read it for us, you may have picked up a couple of hints that we relate to Jesus, especially at Christmas time. Bethlehem is mentioned. If you've read through to the end of chapter 4, you'll know that King David is mentioned and there's a birth of a precious child. All sort of rings bells, doesn't it, at Christmas? And of course, Ruth herself is mentioned in Jesus' genealogy, in Jesus' family tree at the beginning of Matthew's gospel. This book is deeply significant, even though it's really rather small. Because whilst its focus is on a single family rather than the whole nation of Israel, this book plays a very significant part in God's plans for his whole world. And as we've been thinking this past few weeks over Advent, we see how God's plans come to fulfillment in the birth of our Lord Jesus Christ. But we're going to work back through the family tree, as it were, and spend a bit of time thinking about Ruth. So let's jump in then. Chapter 1 is what we're looking at this morning, page 267, if you want to follow along, where in verse 1 we're given the when and the where. We're told that this all takes place in the days when the judges ruled. It was Charles Dickens who famously begins his novel Tale of Two Cities with the words, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." Well, as Ruth begins, one would struggle to see how the days when the judges ruled were anything but the worst of times. With the help of the timeline there, we can see that Ruth is taking place in the time of the judges, and it should be the best of times, because not long before judges, they've entered the promised land. They've been rescued from Egypt, and they're in the promised land, and where they should be enjoying peace and rest, enjoying God and enjoying serving God. But it's the worst of times. Just look back a page, as it were, to the end of the book of Judges, the very final verse, verse 25. In those days, the days of the judges, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. So these days of the judges, they're actually a real low point in Israel's history. They may be in the promised land, but they're all doing just what they like. No king doesn't just mean no speech to listen to on Christmas Day. It means everyone is doing what is right in their own eyes, following their own rules, making them up as they go along, deciding for themselves what is right or wrong, serving no other king but themselves. That's hardly a recipe for peace and goodwill, is it? Hence, if you were to read through the book of Judges, it makes for really grim reading, because we see a pattern develop in the book of Judges where the people keep wandering away from God and doing their own thing, living apart from him, doing evil in the eyes of the Lord. The result is that things go horribly wrong. And it's only when they're really desperate, do they then cry out to God for help as a last resort rather than as a first port of call. Whereafter God in his mercy sends a judge, that is a rescuer, a ruler who brings peace to the land. That all happens for a while, but then what happens? Well, they turn their backs on God again, and the cycle begins again. It is during this time of selfishness and sadness, violence and oppression, disobedience and despair that we zoom in and focus on a single family living in Israel. And given that it is the worst of times for the nation, it should come as no surprise to us then that chapter 1 contains its fair share of sadness and despair as well. Please don't misunderstand me. The book of Ruth as a whole is a story full of hope. We move from famine to fortune, emptiness to fullness, death to life. But it's not where it begins. We're reminded we are in the days when the judges ruled. If that's the when our story begins, well, let's think about where, because this is just as important. Verse 1 again, we begin, don't we, in the land, in Bethlehem, in Judah, the promised land. Verse 2, we see Elimelech and his wife Naomi and their two sons, they're living in Bethlehem, in Judah, in the promised land. But they don't stay there. They decide to move to Moab. And as we work through chapter 1, the decisions people make are a key feature of the chapter, which way they decide to turn. The verb to turn back, to return, is mentioned 12 times in this one chapter. Now, in our translation, it's tweaked a little so as not to sound too repetitive. Do you remember how at primary school, if you had to write a story, you were told to not use the same word twice, rather dig out a thesaurus and come up with some variation? Well, in Hebrew, actually, the repetition is really important. So we're better off ditching the thesaurus and instead grabbing a highlighter. Because when we do, we see that this word turn, to return, to turn back, comes all throughout. And it is the decisions people make to turn or to return which is supposed to grab our attention as we consider this chapter. The direction of people's travel is important. So with this in mind, let's move to our first heading. And it's this: Elimelech and Naomi's turning away from the promised land brings emptiness. You may already know that Bethlehem translates as the house of bread. But there's a problem, isn't there? There is no bread in the house of bread. There's a famine in the land. But there is food in Moab. So Elimelech and his family move to Moab. Now, on the face of it, because of the famine, their move to Moab might look like a good idea, quite pragmatic, quite expedient. Except it's really not that simple. You see, for the original reader, their draw would drop at this point. They'd spit out their tea, they'd choke on their biscuit. Move where? To Moab. You can't be serious. You see, Moab wasn't a neutral place. It's not just the change of postcode born out of pragmatism. This signals a change of heart. It is a departure from the promised land and the Lord who made those promises. See, up to this point in Israel's history, Moab has been the enemy. So, for example, in Judges itself, we read how Moab enslaves the people of Israel for 18 years. Not only that, in Moab, well, they worship other gods. Their behavior is marked by idolatry and immorality and other grotesque religious practices. Move to Moab. You can't be serious. But there's more. It's not only that it's a dodgy destination. The fact that they leave the promised land in the first place is a warning. Things were bad in Israel. There was a reason for the famine, and it wasn't just the weather. You see, when God rescued his people from slavery in Egypt and said, I will take you to the promised land, and brought them there, he said that now that you live in this land, if you honor me, things will go well. You will be blessed. You will enjoy a good relationship with me and all that the promised land has to offer, the land flowing with milk and honey. They'd be in God's land, enjoying God's rule and blessing as God's people. All will be well. But if they dishonored God, indeed disobeyed him, ignoring his grace towards them in rescuing them in the first place, and instead doing their own thing, what is right in their own eyes, well, things will go badly. There would be consequences, God warned. Disaster would come in one form or another. Now, the purpose of that was to wake them up, to bring them to their senses, to encourage them to recognize their relationship with God is on the rocks because of what they've done. And significantly, one of those consequences was famine. So this famine in the days when everyone did as they saw fit, it's not simply a lack of bread. It's a lack of trust in God. It should be a sign to them that something is very, very wrong. It's a shaking of their shoulders to humble them, encourage them to return to God in repentance. Because when they do, they will find God welcomes them with open arms. So Elimelech and Naomi, they have a decision to make, don't they? Either recognize the famine as a call to return to God, knowing he's gracious and compassionate, kind and forgiving, their proven rescuer and redeemer, return to him or turn away from him. Turn away from the promised land to Moab. Elimelech's name translates as God is my king. But in painful irony, Elimelech chooses to do what is right in his own eyes and turn away. He should know that man cannot live on bread alone, but they choose to give it a go anyway. So they're not looking with the eyes of faith. They're not listening to what God has said. Instead, they look to what they can see in Moab and the food. And so in deciding the grass is greener, they turn their backs on God. They flee from the land of promise to the land of compromise. And don't we all know the temptation to do this ourselves, especially in a moment of crisis, to ignore the promises God has made to us as Christians, the promises that are yes in Christ Jesus. See, if we're a Christian believer today, the promises of the land, peace, rest, security, provision, faithfulness, blessing, well, they're all fulfilled in Jesus. As Christians, we receive those promises in a person, not a postcode. Jesus promises to provide all we need. Not everything we want, but everything we need. But when we don't receive what we want, well, the temptation is to take matters into our own hands. Do what is right in our own eyes instead. Turn to look at Moab. Think the grass is greener. So it is with a heavy heart that we read of Elimelech and Naomi's decision to move to Moab. But as we read on, we see that the sorrow is only just beginning. They say it'll be just for a little while, but they settle. They end up spending 10 years there, and it's during the time in Moab that tragedy strikes. Moab promised so much. It promised life. But for Naomi and her family, it brings only death. We read of how Elimelech dies, and then 10 years later, Naomi's two sons die as well. And on the top of the heartache she faces, it's even worse for Naomi, because in the culture of the day, it meant she hasn't only lost her husband and her sons, but her status, her security, and her provision. It is perhaps hard for us to fully empathize with Naomi, but we are given some hints as to the depth of her pain, aren't we? In verse 20, when she says later of how she no longer wants to be called Naomi, then Naomi means pleasant. She says instead, call me Mara. It means bitter. And in verse 21, she speaks of how she felt full when she left for Moab, but now only emptiness. She left with a husband and two sons, but now all she has is their memory. Life is bitter for Naomi. But there in verse 21, it's not only a helpful summary of what she's been through, it is a hopeful one. Did you notice the return word there in verse 21? I went away, says Naomi, but the Lord has brought me back. The Lord has returned me. See, through it all, the Lord has not abandoned Naomi. The Lord has brought her back to the land of promise, to the land of blessing, where not only we read how Naomi has returned, but so is the food. The harvest is beginning. So the chapter does end with an element of hope. Naomi never entirely turns her back on God. For as sad as all this is for her, something which she is brutally honest about, she never abandons God. She always sees God's hand at work. She knows he's there. So as the chapter ends, it's a hint that it's not the end of Naomi's story. And indeed, it's not. Read on if you want to find out what happens. But we may also have raised an eyebrow at Naomi describing herself as empty, because she's returned to Bethlehem. The Lord has brought her back. And he hasn't brought her back alone, has he? For stood beside her is her daughter-in-law, Ruth. So we may ask the question, well, is Naomi really empty? Well, thinking about Ruth brings us to our second heading, and it's this. Ruth's turning to the promised land reveals her loving commitment to the Lord. See, back in verse 6, they hear that there's bread in Bethlehem. The Lord is once again providing for his people in the promised land. Naomi says, well, now is the time to leave the compromised land and return to the promised land herself. So off she goes along with Orpah and Ruth, her two daughters-in-law. And we read how in verse 7, they've left their home. They're on the road back to Judah, but they pause and have a conversation. And they reach a crossroads where decisions need to be made on which way to turn. Will they return to Bethlehem? Will they turn back to Moab? And as emotional as the goodbye is, Naomi seems very keen for her daughters-in-law to return home to Moab. Naomi's point is simply that as far as her daughters-in-law are concerned, the cupboard is still bare in Bethlehem. Yes, the bread is coming back, but Naomi sees no future for Ruth or Orpah there. Now, they have a bit of a discussion about this, and there's lots of tears and weeping as they think about being parted. But in verse 14, Orpah does return to Moab. Ruth, we're told, clings to Naomi. So verse 15, Ruth, she looks and she sees all that Moab has to offer her, not least a family and a future. And yet with the eyes of faith, she turns towards Naomi, towards Bethlehem, towards God's people, towards the Lord. They are remarkable words of Ruth in verse 16 and 17. Do look at them again with me. Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me." They're beautiful words of Ruth, and they demonstrate her commitment to Naomi, don't they? That's very clear. But there's more than just her commitment to Naomi going on here, because Ruth commits to stay living in the promised land even after Naomi dies. Ruth says, "I will stay there and I will die there." She is committing to the people of the land and the God of the land. Why? Well, because as she said, she now takes Naomi's God to be her God. The God who has already promised in Exodus and Leviticus. Look at these verses with me. Again and again, God says, "I will be your God and you will be my people." Well, Ruth, in speaking to Naomi, is echoing these words, isn't she? In her commitment to Naomi, yes, but in her commitment to the Lord. So these past 10 years in Moab, in spite of the tragedy they faced as a family and the flawed reasoning of Elimelech and Naomi to leave in the first place, not to mention their compromised witness, in amongst all of that, Ruth has come to understand and appreciate for herself something of the beauty, the majesty, the trustworthiness, the loveliness, the faithfulness of the Lord God of Israel, the God of the Bible. She's learned that from her in-laws. No one else in Moab is going to teach her that. She's learned that from her family. She's come to a point where she knows the Lord is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in love and faithfulness. So what is she doing knowing what this God is like? Well, she entrusts her life to him. So of course, verse 16, Ruth won't return to Moab, to their gods and the people there, because she's now following the one true God, holding to his promises, committed to his people. It's a wonderful picture of a conversion, isn't it? Someone who didn't follow the Lord, now turning, quite literally, but also spiritually, to follow the Lord. It's not just a change of postcode, it's a change of heart. Here's how one writer puts it. The form of Ruth's poem, with God at the centre, mirrors the shape of Ruth's heart. So Naomi returns to Bethlehem, and Ruth turns to Bethlehem herself. And with it, as I say in verse 22, the chapter ends. There is a glimmer of hope. The chapter began with famine, but now the barley harvest is just beginning. So our story is well underway. But as we finish chapter one, just one question for us all to be thinking through. Which way are we facing? What is our direction of travel? People's turning and returning is the drumbeat of the chapter. So it's good to think through our own turning and returning. Can I say, if you're with us this morning, you wouldn't yet call yourself a Christian. I hope you're encouraged by what you see here in Ruth. Because in her turning and committing herself to God and his people, she echoes God's commitment to all, to any who turn to him. I will be your God, and you will be my people. See, as a Moabite, we might have assumed she would be turned away. When she says all this to Naomi, Naomi could have said, "Don't be ridiculous. You're a Moabite. You won't be welcome." That's not what happens, is it? She's not turned away. She is welcomed. We might have thought turning is simply not an option for someone like Ruth. But we're reminded that God welcomes all who turn to him, regardless of background or merit. It's why Jesus, the descendant of Ruth, when he came to offer rest to the weary, not the religious. Rest to the burdened, not the brilliant. You see, in Jesus, there is a welcome for a Moabite like Ruth. There's a welcome for the marginalized. There's a welcome for the flawed and the fragile. All who turn to God will receive him as their God and his people as their people. But if we're a Christian, well, it's good for us to check our heads and hearts aren't being turned as well, isn't it? That temptation to think the grass is greener away from Jesus. We all face seasons of struggling to trust that God is for us. And so the repeated language of turning and returning here, well, it encourages us to think about which way we're facing at the moment. Are we looking to move to Moab, tempted to live by what we see rather than by faith in the God who has spoken? 2023 was another disorientating year, wasn't it? And circumstances can do strange things to our hearts. So which way are we facing? Are we walking by faith towards Bethlehem, towards Jesus, the Christ, our King? Or is our heart turned away, thinking life can be found elsewhere away from Jesus, doing what is right in our own eyes? If that's you, can I encourage you to return? We're all prone to wander. Naomi went away, didn't she? But the Lord brought her back. Naomi wandered. The Lord went and fetched her. If we're wandering now, we need to know that the Lord is still committed to us too and calling us to return. Even though we can be faithless, he is always faithful. Though she's going through a difficult time, Naomi, she doesn't abandon God. She did have to pack her bags though, didn't she? And walk the road back to Bethlehem. Maybe some of us need to be doing that as well. I'm going to finish there. We're going to have a moment's quiet, and then we're going to have a chance to respond in the words of our next song. The words, "Be Thou My Vision," well-known hymn, but the words help us commit or recommit ourselves to following Jesus. You'll see there in the final verse, "Christ of my own heart, whatever befall, be thou my vision, O ruler of all." Jesus is our King. He's the one we're to look to. He's the one we're to follow. May God in his mercy and by his Spirit keep our eyes fixed on him. As I say, a moment to reflect, and then please do stand to sing as the music starts.